Welcome to On the Brink with Jeff Wefferson, episode number 8. I'm talking to you from Hobart, Tasmania, former whaling capital of the Southern Hemisphere, maybe 100 years ago. In today's show, I'm going to pick up where I left off with last week's show, talking about the whales and dolphins. I was talking about the idea of the possibility, if the right people with the right influence and resources decided they really wanted to do it, it could easily be done to create what I call a weather channel for the real global threats to all the whales and dolphins everywhere in the world, but specifically focusing here on Tasmania, in Tasmanian waters, because of this rescue group that I've made touch with here. As I was saying before, they're a branch of the Department of Primary Industries, and they're called the Threatened Species Marine Project. They've my friend Wade Carson, who runs the most brilliant blog about whales and dolphins that exists, called Stranded No More, reckons that this rescue group is one of the best, if not the best, in the whole world because of their very high success rate and their willingness to attempt to rescue and refloat whales and dolphins that other organizations, like their miserable counterpart in New Zealand, would even think of doing. The tendency in New Zealand lately has just been to euthanize, i.e., shoot in the head any whales or dolphins that they just didn't feel like putting the effort into trying to help or save them. We don't want to dwell on the gruesome aspects here, but it is very gruesome. It's beyond belief what's really happening with all the whales and dolphins on our entire planet. And this is just based on the relatively small amount of information that we actually have, because it's clear that humans basically live on land, although we can be found in small numbers anywhere, but we basically are land-dwelling, and we don't self-locomote at great speed, whereas the whales and dolphins basically live in the vast, vast majority of the surface of our planet, both in terms of surface area and cubic volume. I think the ocean is like, I don't know how many millions or billions of cubic miles of water. They're pretty much free to go under their own power anywhere in there. The encroachment of human military industrial activity, noise and pollution, and just our physical presence is really driving a stake through their ability to live harmoniously and happily and healthily on the planet where they've existed in their present form, as far as we know, for tens of millions of years. Long, long, long before anything calling itself Homo sapiens ever came into being. This is what mainstream science tells us. We don't really know because we weren't there, or maybe our ancestors were. But I wanted to sort of reiterate the idea of the Weather Channel. For anybody who's listening to this live, I wanted to apologize for some possible technical glitches in last week's show, because I used, in the background, I used some whale sounds that was from a track that I was unfamiliar with the entirety of the track. It was a whale CD sent to me by a brilliant German sort of scientific researcher named Alexander Lauterwasser, who I would really like to thank for his help and continued help and future help with creating some cymatic movies for us to use in our Beyond film that we're gradually working on. It's called Ahi Te Hora Pakia Wananga, which in Maori means the knowledge and wisdom of whales and dolphins. You can watch the trailer for that on my blog, Tutunui Wananga, or from our main website, dolphinmatrix.com/Jeff. Alexander had sent me a CD of the music that he used for one of his whale cymatic videos, which we use some of it, a little of it in the film. But when I took that whale sounds from the CD and put them underneath my last week's show, and Jules at UCY-TV told me that towards the end there were some noise and sloshing sounds, and it sounded like the whale sounds were going backwards and it sort of distorted. So I'm not sure exactly where my show might have got cut off last time, but what I'd like to do is talk about the whole idea of a cetacean Weather Channel in terms of monitoring the physical proximity and location coordinates of all human marine activity in any given area. What I'll actually do right now is read my cetacean and ocean section of a new article that I just wrote for Auckland-based Uncensored Magazine. I'd really like to thank editor John Eisen for his ongoing support, generosity, and patience in giving me the time to finish this article, which is going to be in the next issue, which should be on the stands in New Zealand by the first week in March, and in stands in Australia and the UK by the third week in March. He is hoping to have distribution in America, but right now he's printing about 25,000 copies of each issue. I've had articles in 5 out of the last 6 issues, counting this upcoming one, so that's roughly 25,000 people reading my articles in each issue. And my Tutanui Wananga blog is up to about 40,000, 35,000 or 40,000 hits right now, which is pretty good for a completely nonprofit endeavor. And I don't mean nonprofit in the sense of like Paul Watson. I mean nonprofit in the sense that I don't get money from anybody for any reason having to do with whales and dolphins or anything like that. This article, it's basically called a freelance intelligence update, and it's got about 5 different sections. And this section is the cetaceans and ocean section, and you can read this on the Tutanui Wananga blog. Whales and dolphins are stranding and dying at alarming levels all around the planet, but New Zealand is the new Taiji because of the huge number of these cetacean fatalities. Almost without exception, every stranding event in recent years correlates with seismic testing and or military hazardous operations in the vicinity at the same time, yet this obvious connection goes unmentioned by the media, government, and scientific agencies, and almost all environmental groups. The cetaceans are a true extraterrestrial intelligence, and we are waging war on them. Wade Carson, Canadian marine biologist and founder of the brilliant site Stranded No More, points out that the whale and dolphin rescue operations there are the worst in the world, with a success rate of only 9%. Further, necropsies that could determine the actual cause of death are never carried out on the dead cetaceans. The reason given is that the Maori object to this on spiritual grounds, but they are allowed to hack off jawbones and take whatever they want. Maori traditional owners and council, moreover, are among the most corrupt politicians in Aotearoa, and are heavily involved in facilitating and capitalizing on all forms of energy and resource extraction, which are now exploding throughout New Zealand's huge EEZ, or Exclusive Economic Zone, the 5th largest in the world. Denial of necropsy is a sure way to protect big oil. The most recent of many dozens of such events occurred just this week when a sperm whale stranded on the North Island near Paraparaumu in the vicinity of not one but 2 seismic testing operations. This tells the whole story, one that we have seen repeatedly in recent years. Mainstream, that is, Navy or big oil-funded scientists, are quick to point out that cetacean strandings have been known to occur since the days of the ancient Greeks, and of course any reality is far more complex than even the most dedicated scientific pursuit can comprehend. When strandings or unusual deaths occur, the trend these days is to conjure up any possible explanation, for example, that the whale died from old age, or a mystery illness, or it just got lost. These things do happen, of course, but we know beyond a shadow of doubt that seismic testing and naval sonars emit shockwaves of sound that are powerful enough to kill or maim thousands of cetaceans with one blast. LFA sonar is reputed to have a kill zone the size of Texas. Hundreds of seismic testing vessels are in operation at any given time around the planet, and hundreds if not thousands of military vessels from the world's navies are deployed everywhere, on the surface and in the depths, on routine missions, engaging in war games, weapons, testing maneuvers, disposing of ordnance and radioactive waste, and, of course, fighting the enemy in the global war on terror. All this is on top of the massive amounts of noise from shipping and recreational vessels, fishing vessels, and just any human marine presence. Almost every marine vessel of any size has one or more forms of sonar these days. Sonar, which stands for Sonic Navigation and Ranging, is not a passive listening system, but active in the sense that it emits pulses or blasts of sounds. Ping is hardly appropriate for a 30,000 joule blast that are detected upon reflection back to the source. It's impossible to imagine the density of sonar interference that exists in areas with a lot of marine vessel activity. Even if the sound levels aren't powerful enough to cause physical injury, cetaceans have extremely acute hearing and are bound to be disturbed or annoyed at the constant anthropogenic noise spectrum that is probably very difficult, if not impossible, to get away from. A weather channel for real global threats. Here in Tasmania, I've recently contacted the Threatened Species Marine Group of the Department of Primary Industries, reckoned by Wade Carson to be one of the best cetacean rescue groups in the world. Already talked with Chris Carleon, who related that the last major stranding event was on King Island a few months ago, and that the cause was a mystery. I asked him if he was aware that the Australian Navy had been conducting tests of new torpedo technologies at that exact time off of Adelaide, which isn't that far from King Island. He was aware of this and was not reluctant to talk about military-industrial activity as a cause of strandings. Hopefully, I will be doing a full interview with him and other team members in the next couple of weeks, in which I'm going to find out exactly where they're coming from with all this. I'm going to suggest that if they want to go to the next level with what they're supposed to be about, that is, protecting the lives of marine mammals and not just sit there like ambulance drivers waiting for strandings to happen, that they create what I call a weather channel for real-time surveillance of all human marine activity in Tasmanian waters, including seismic testing and geophysical exploration activity, military presence or activity of any kind, all other industrial activity, including fishing boats, trawlers, shipping cruise ships, and recreational vessels. All of these use various kinds of sonar. All of these create physical disturbances, noise, and their presence is a threat to any marine life. Seismic testing vessels and military sonars generate shockwaves that can kill or injure hundreds of thousands of cetaceans at once, more than the Japanese whaling fleet would kill in an entire season unfettered by Captain Paul Watson's band of made-for-TV pseudo-activists. The technology for such a weather channel is readily available. Pretty much anyone with sufficient access to the marine databases could assemble such an intelligence apparatus. Access to classified information such as nuclear submarine deployment can be tricky, but it's not impossible for a government agency with the will to do this. With such a system in operation, we could constantly observe the relative positions of all marine vessels, pay attention to the density of activity in any given area, note any correlations between conspicuous presences and elevated densities with strandings or anomalous cetacean behaviors, and possibly begin to predict when these types of events might occur. One of the main problems is that when a seismic blast maims or kills hundreds or thousands of cetaceans, as off the coast of Peru a few months ago, the vast majority of the dead or injured cetaceans do not end up on shore, but sink and decompose in the ocean. Wade Carson estimates that for events of this nature, as few as 10% of all the injured cetaceans end up on shore. And the biggest obstacle with a program like the Cetacean Weather Channel is that its creation would be a de facto admission of the dangers it posed by human marine military-industrial activity, indeed by marine activity of any kind. The pervasive and tentacular influence of big oil and the war on terror mindset, which glorifies the high-tech, big-stick approach to global imperialism, would surely try to abort such a project before it could become fully operational, particularly here in Australia, a country that is run by mining companies and qualifies as both a British colony and the 51st state of America, the Obama nation. This is John Pilger, the investigative journalist, talking, not just me. Last week, I unfriended Australian Minister of the Environment, whose title should really be the Minister of Extraction, Tony Burke, on Facebook, for making ridiculous Orwellian proclamations. For example, he said that, quote, if every country acted like Japan, we wouldn't have any whales left, unquote. I replied, if every country acted like Australia, we'd all have been extinct a long time ago. Then he said that Australia is the world leader in protecting the oceans. I replied that if allowing the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Park to be dredged near Gladstone to clear the way for supertankers going to six new gas hubs, allowing a major humpback whale nursery to be dredged near James Price Point near Broome in the Kimberley, allowing offshore exploration and deep water drilling for hydrocarbons near Ningaloo Reef in Western Australia, off of Kangaroo Island and who knows where all else, not to mention allowing new uranium mines in Western Australia and open-cut mining for iron compounds in the remote Tarkine Wilderness region of Western Tasmania. If all of this is protecting the ocean and environment, well, Tony, that's really no different than when your ancestors declared that Australia was terra nullius when they first set their necropolis feet here 150 years ago. Terra nullius means land of nothing or land of no people, and was the British invaders' justification for mass murdering all the subhuman creatures who had lived so peacefully in the Dreamtime for 100,000 years. It's also very interesting to note some things about Charles Darwin here. I'm reading from a blog post by a guy named M. Williams. It's called The Full Title of Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Those who argue at school board meetings that Darwin should be taught in public schools seldom have taken the time to read him. If they knew the full title of On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races and the Struggle for Life, they might have gained some inkling of the racism propagated by this controversial theorist. Had they actually read Origin, they likely would be shocked to learn that among Darwin's scientifically based proposals was the elimination of the Negro and Australian peoples, which he considered savage races whose continued survival was hindering the progress of civilization. In his next book, The Descent of Man, from 1871, Darwin ranked races in terms of what he believed was their nearness and likeness to gorillas. Then he went on to propose the extermination of races he scientifically defined as inferior. If this were not done, he claimed, those races with much higher birth rates than superior races would exhaust the resources needed for the survival of better people. This exhaustion of resources would eventually drag down all of civilization. Darwin even argued that advanced society should not waste time and money on caring for the mentally ill or those with birth defects. To him, these unfit members of our species ought not to survive. Very, very interesting. The words of Charles Darwin. The cetaceans are the ultimate indigenous people, and our very proactive genocidal war on them and on all indigenous peoples around the world and the Earth herself is extremely bad karma for beings professing to be Homo sapiens, man to wise. Now I'd like to read three quotations from three very influential minds of the 20th century that I think, in their own way, each of these touches on a very, very central and fundamental issues that are confronting humanity and where we are on the brink of the unknown and the unknowable. The first one is a quote from Adlai Stevenson in 1964. He was an American political person. I think he ran for president. He was sort of a contemporary of John F. Kennedy. This quote is credited to be the origin of the expression spaceship Earth. We travel together, passengers on a little spaceship, dependent upon its vulnerable reserves of air and soil, all committed for our safety to its security and peace, preserved from annihilation only by the care, the work, and I will say the love we give our fragile craft. We cannot maintain it half fortunate, half miserable, half confident, half despairing, half slave to the ancient enemies of man, half free in a liberation of resources undreamed of until this day. No craft, no crew, can safely travel with such vast contradictions. On their resolution depends the survival of us all. Adlai Stevenson, 1964. I think the most important thing about this is he's pointing out that our minds in general and our whole reality is riddled with contradictions. The second quote is from Robert Lawler, who lives on King Island, Tasmania, an American author. It's from his book called Voices of the First Day, Awakening in the Aboriginal Dreamtime. We are blinded by the delusions that rise from our hollow and rotting social order. It is vain pomposity to believe that humanity can advance while the earth and its native peoples, plants and animals, are enslaved, desecrated, and destroyed. The third quote is from theoretical physicist David Bohm, who was a student of Albert Einstein, did some very, very interesting work with quantum physics, and then he sort of forged ahead into a whole new region of theoretical, a region where theoretical physics blends with psychology and metaphysics and cosmology. He came up with a concept called the holo movement, and his idea was that there's basically two domains of reality: the implicate holo movement, which is the sort of enfolded, non-manifest world of potentiality, infinite creation, and consciousness that's beyond space and time, physical form, and the forces of nature, which reminds me sort of like the Aboriginal concept of the dream time. And then the explicate order, or explicate holo movement, that's the domain of physical time and space, the world of nature, the world of form and matter and energy. Very interesting concept. I think our whole society tries to stabilize itself by starting out to destroy sensitivity to incoherence, starting with very young children. If people could see the vast incoherence that is going on in society, they would be disturbed and they would feel the need to do something. If you're not sensitive to it, you don't feel disturbed and you don't feel you need to do anything. I remember an instance, a daughter was telling her mother, "This school is terrible, the teacher is terrible, very inconsistent, doing all sorts of crazy things," and so on. Finally, the mother was saying, "You'd better stop this. In this house, the teacher is always right." Now, she understood that the teacher was wrong, obviously, but the message was it was no use. Even the message may have been right in some sense, but still it illustrates that the predicament is that in order to avoid this sort of trouble, starting with very young children, we are trained to become insensitive to incoherence. If there is incoherence in our behavior, we thereby also become insensitive to it. David Bohm, from a seminar on thought and dialogue in Ojai, California, November 4th, 1989. For the next little bit, I'm going to read some more from my article called "We Are Not Alone Yet: How We Are Waging War on a True Extraterrestrial Intelligence." This is my comprehensive article on the whales and dolphins that was published in 2 issues ago in an uncensored magazine. It's also the basic framework that our Beyond film, Ahi Tohoro Pakia Wananga, is based on. In the last radio show, I read from a section called "Living in Water." What I'm doing here is trying to establish sort of like who the cetaceans, the whales and dolphins, actually are as biological beings, how similar they are to us as mammals, but how completely different they are to us, and how the central idea, it was the idea that Dr. John Lilly came up with when he was working with these astronomers and astrophysicists on the concept of extraterrestrial intelligence. It only makes sense. I mean, just even from just a purely logical, linear, scientific perspective, if you want to try to communicate with beings that aren't from here, you need to be able to communicate and understand and respect and live in harmony with the beings that are already on your planet. If it's very psychotic and schizophrenic to think you're going to even have any kind of attempt to understand something that's not even from your world, if you're just walking over, killing and destroying and murdering fellow beings that have been here all along, that are desperately crying out to you to ask us to stop killing them and stop being so stupid. So this is the spirit of my work, my activism and research work in terms of communicating with people via mass media about the whales and dolphins, is to try to clarify and stimulate you to do your own work, whether it's in nature with real whales and dolphins or through literature or other people's work, or just, you know, to sort of tune into them in real time psychologically, because they're beaming very powerfully telepathically. And I think that it's a really powerful wavelength to be on. Like I was saying before, they've been here so much longer than us that they would have been at their current level of cognitional and psychic abilities before we even evolved. I mean, this is from sort of like a mainstream scientific perspective in terms of the beliefs about time and evolution and things like that. Who knows how it's really happened, but that's the sort of mainstream model that we're we've all sort of agreed upon. I'm not saying it's really real, but I'm just saying that I think that they've been here a lot longer than us, and so we've evolved in their presence, just like we've evolved in the presence of many kinds of radiation, including electromagnetic radiation from the sun, low-level radionuclides occurring from supernovas that are in the surface of the Earth, like uranium. It's when we concentrate it and mobilize it that becomes dangerous. But we've lived with radiation in a true sense. We've always had the cetacean presence on our planet the whole time we've been here. So that's a very fundamental fact to be aware of. I read from a section called Living in Water, in which I was contrasting, speculating in sort of an elementary way on the differences between what it's like living in water all the time, like not just some of the time, but all the time. You're completely free from gravity. You're able to move on your own in three dimensions. You're limited in terms of your ability to see with light, but to perceive your environment using sound, to create pictures using sound, to communicate with sound, it's similar to us, but different. And because of the importance of this paragraph, I'm going to read it again. It's talking about ideas that Russian psychoanalyst Emmanuel Velikovsky talked about in terms of what it's been like for life forms that live on the surface of the Earth, how we've been collectively traumatized by repeated cosmic catastrophes of extraterrestrial origin throughout the whole history of the Earth, but up into and into historical times. And I believe that these energies have been a major influence on who and what we are now and what we've become as human beings. Possibly, we talk about physical mutation of DNA in our bodies and stuff, but no one's ever talked about the idea of psychic mutation, the mutation of our thought process, of our beliefs and worldviews. And I don't mean self-mutation like we're doing now through mass media and fiction and fake reality and the Weltanschauungskrieg, but I'm talking about psychic mutation from cosmic influences. In the paradigm of cataclysmic evolution formulated most notably by Emmanuel Velikovsky, extraterrestrially originating catastrophes on a planetary scale have influenced the development of life on Earth far more than the long, slow, uniformitarian natural selection processes of Lyell and Darwin. Beings living in the sea would be much safer in general in the event of an asteroid or cometary collision, as water is physically more protective than air. Sea beings are accustomed to living with little or no light and could successfully ride out prolonged periods of climatic instability or even darkness and atmospheric disturbance due to smoke from volcanic eruptions or asteroid or cometary impacts. According to Velikovsky's in-depth research, geological as well as historical records show conclusively that cataclysms such as these are the norm for our planet. He concluded that the virulence with which mainstream science has denied the reality of this entire paradigm, even in the face of overwhelming evidence, is due to the collective traumatization that humanity has undergone from repeated cosmic catastrophe. In other words, what happened in our distant past to our ancestors was so horrific that not only do we as a whole refuse to remember it, we are also unconsciously reenacting these destructive traumas by creating our most advanced forms of technology as weapons, now turned against ourselves and all other life. Beings living in the sea like the whales and dolphins would have been far less traumatized by these events and would have been shielded from the endless energetic bombardments that I believe have created a state of permanent psychic mutation in Homo sapiens. This is another but related story that could help to explain what seems to have gone wrong with man the wise. Now, I'll also continue by reading the next section of my article. It's called Primates versus Cetaceans. Those are two orders under the class Mammalia in the Linnaean taxonomic system of zoological classification. Compared to life forms that live on the land, those who live in the sea are of necessity more obscure and elusive to the peeping toms of scientific research and photojournalism. Cetaceans in particular are not only in constant motion from the depths of the ocean to the surface to breathe, but also in constant migration around the planet. They are generally inaccessible and therefore more difficult to study than humans and other terrestrial life forms. Non-invasive research on cetaceans in their natural environment is extremely difficult, if not impossible. The vast majority of this work is conducted in highly injurious and unethical ways and amounts to studying prisoners in a concentration camp. In terms of zoology, we are primates and the whales and dolphins are cetaceans, two orders of the class Mammalia. Mammals are warm-blooded, air-breathing animals that suckle their young. Primates are basically land-dwelling, upright, and four-limbed with hands. They are the monkeys, apes, and humans. Cetaceans are sea-dwelling mammals with highly streamlined bodies and are capable of rapid extended self-locomotion. Cetaceans have flukes or flippers but no hands, and they breathe voluntarily as opposed to the automatic breathing of most other mammals. They are the porpoises, dolphins, and whales. Like humans, they have advanced social and communication systems. Zoologists have classified them into two groups, the toothed whales or Odontoceti and the baleen whales or Mysticeti. Odontoceti includes the dolphins, orcas, and sperm whales, who have the largest brains on the planet. Mysticeti includes the fin, gray, blue, right, and humpback whales, and are the largest life forms on the Earth. Symmetrically, we should actually be comparing primates and cetaceans, because humans are only one species out of hundreds of primates, yet hundreds of species of cetaceans exist. The limitations of the Linnaean taxonomic system notwithstanding, it's very interesting to note that cetacea is diverse yet homogeneous. With primates, it seems that a lot of gaps exist, a lot of, should I say, missing links. Why are there no primates more similar to us than chimpanzees? Some researchers believe that what we call Neanderthal man originally coexisted with Homo sapiens but then became extinct. Contrary to popular delusion, the story goes that Neanderthal man wore clothes, used tools, made jewelry. Not only that, he was quite musical and is believed to have played instruments and sang. His was a Neolithic and probably shamanic culture. That Neanderthal man was probably killed off by our distant ancestors may not be so much a testament to human nature as to aberrant behavior due to permanent psychic mutation. Since humans and cetaceans are both mammals, we are quite similar at the most fundamental levels of biology and physiology, but very important differences exist. One is that they do not breathe automatically like we do, but voluntarily, from once every few minutes for dolphins up to once every hour and a half for a deep-diving sperm whale. They also do not ever sit or lie down anywhere unless they are stranded on a beach. They are in motion, floating and self-locomoting in water all the time. From what is known, cetaceans in general do not sleep for great lengths of time and are believed to sleep with half of their brain with one eye closed at a time. This is a phenomenal adaptation. Hands versus flippers. Cetaceans also do not have hands. This is an extremely important distinction. Actually, they do have hands. The bones in their flippers are almost identical to the bones in our hands. Paleontologists tell us that the cetaceans were once land-dwelling beings who then returned to the sea. How something like this can happen staggers the imagination and forces us to confront the limitations of what we think of as time. If this is true, whatever influence was behind this return must have been quite powerful. When they lived on land, were their ancestors quadrupeds, as most researchers believe, or might they have actually had hands? And if so, what kind of force would be so overwhelming as to influence an entire order of life forms to give up hands? Having hands and the ever-popular opposable thumb is central to being human. A very large part of what we think of as being human is a product of hands. Hands are essential for manipulating our external environment and indispensable for the creation and utilization of tools, the earliest example of which is believed to have been a weapon. But what if it was a drumstick? Primates other than humans have hands, of course, but they don't use them quite as extensively as do we. Cetaceans, on the other hand, not only don't have hands per se, but they don't appear to need them. In fact, they seem to have attained a much higher degree of perfection and adaptation to their environment than we could ever hope to reach. Their bodies, for example, are insulated, streamlined, and lubricated to such a high degree that they can live in extremes of temperature we could not possibly survive without clothing and/or buildings. They can swim in three dimensions down to depths that would crush humans, and at speeds several times faster than any human could self-locomote in any medium. They don't need hands. This is another huge leap for the mainstream Western mentality, you might ask. So how can cetaceans be intelligent if they don't have hands? Ah, the wonders of anthropocentrism. I think a more appropriate question is, do we really need hands? In the sections of the article that I've just read, I was sort of trying to describe the similarities and differences of cetaceans and people as in terms of being biological or zoological beings. But now we're going to enter some new territory. It's the area that has to do with internal reality and the ability to communicate. What's the meaning of communication, and how much are we really able to appreciate or understand or comprehend at all the inner experience or reality perception of other beings that aren't human, even of other human beings? Because we, in some ways, it's like we're trapped inside of our own individual self. You can't really be another person, although you can be so close to somebody that it's like being a part of that person. But we're all deeply interconnected with each other. We might exist in separate physical bodies, but we, you know, particularly people that know each other or that are similar in terms of their language or their cultural or social groups, people have so much in common that's what makes a shared reality possible. So there's a lot in common. Everybody has individual differences. But when you try to sort of bridge the gap between humans and another species, especially ones that obviously have all the neurobiological hard and software that's necessary for all the qualities that we have been determined to say that's what makes us humans and we're the only ones that have it. I don't think that's really true. So now we're entering into the territory of looking at the cetaceans as not just beautiful creatures or magnificent animals. They're jumping in the ocean and doing nice things and giving our money to environmental capitalists to protect them from the Japanese whalers. We want to go now into the uncharted territory of going gradually, and only because we are being invited into the minds of the whales and dolphins. The very first thing that I'm going to talk about, I'm going to read a section from my article called Language versus Communication. This is a vast area of exploration, and in this article we'll just be touching on some of the more salient dimensions and trying to illuminate the limitations in the human side of this equation. Language is just one form of communication that is specific to Homo sapiens. It's important to be clear on this. In the same way that cetaceans are truly extraterrestrial, their communications are totally non-linguistic. Language comes from the Latin word for tongue, which is one of our primary biotechnologies for talking, along with lips and larynx. Cetaceans have tongues but do not use them for communicating or making sounds, and don't have lips or larynges. Language per se is unique to humans. We often confuse language with communication, but language is only one of an extremely wide variety of known forms of communication. Every living being, from bacteria and amoebas, to turtles and bamboo, to sequoia trees and slime molds, to giraffes and octopi, to fruit bats and kookaburras, to spider monkeys and geckos, engages in complex forms of communication, from smells and dancing to facial expressions and changing color. Humans like to pretend that we understand these forms of communication and pride ourselves on what they mean. But what do we really know? Not much at all. Communication is often closely associated with intelligence. It's entirely possible that humans may be the subject of much of the communication they observe or study. Pop culture cetacean researchers and New Age cetacean gurus love to talk about dolphin language or whale language, how they've cracked the code and how they are now able to talk to dolphins. Anyone can talk to anything, but is real communication happening? the energy someone has, the look in their eyes, the motion of their fluke, their aura, their body language, their feelings, their intent, their behavior and actions are all part of the communication process. Human language, which is really redundant because only humans use language per se, was originally oral or spoken based on sound. The accepted belief is that it probably existed for hundreds of thousands of years before we invented writing, but there's really no way to really know. Language could be the result of a much more recent psychic mutation that occurred due to cosmic catastrophe. William S. Burroughs even went so far as to suggest that language is a virus. Burroughs would have been referring to symbolic language, of which English and all the other Indo-European tongues are but one genre. These types of languages use words to signify or stand for various things like people, actions, events, objects, ideas, and concepts. Syntax and grammar, or semiotics, are the rules according to which words are combined to convey semantic content or meaning. Symbolic languages are like maps, useful in many ways, but not to be confused with the territory itself. Utterly different forms of language exist, which are probably vastly more ancient and are not based on symbols and maps, but on sound, vibration, and resonance. These analog or harmonic languages do not lend themselves to being written down, but are all about the spoken word. These kinds of language are similar to music in the sense of being non-symbolic forms of communication or expression. The total number of human languages that have come and gone would be impossible to estimate, possibly tens or even hundreds of thousands, each representing a unique perspective on life on Earth, a local worldview no less real, sophisticated, or relevant than any that exists today. The study of indigenous languages has revealed a linguistic relativity of reality between human cultures. To compare the worldviews of humans and cetaceans, I propose a new concept, neuroecological relativity, which explores how reality is perceived by different species. The invention of writing and then printing had a profound influence on human communication. Both are forms of recording or storing information, which is really what memory is all about. Theoretically, if your memory and information transfer skills were good enough, you'd never need writing, printing, or any kind of electronic broadcasting. You could save, share, transmit, receive, and converse over expanses of time and space yourself without the need of external technology or extrasomatic artifacts, in the words of Carl Sagan. Here again is another huge leap for the mainstream Western mentality, who might ask, but how could a being be truly intelligent if it didn't have advanced forms of external technology? There's that pervasive anthropocentrism again. Cetaceans use sound in a variety of ways, including communication. None of these uses even remotely resembles human symbolic language, but some of them do seem to be similar to both harmonic language as well as music. And now, in honor of harmonic languages and music and nonverbal communication using sound that's non-linguistic, I'm going to play some music for the rest of this show. I believe that I'll play some of my own music, maybe some piano music. The first track that I'm going to play, it's actually a sound collage that I did as part of a live performance at a theater in Boulder, Colorado in 1993. I was doing visuals for a band called Midnight Kitchen, and they put me in charge of playing some music during the intermission when they took a break. So what I did was I had three different CD players plugged into the board at the same time, and one of them had Songs of the Humpback Whales. Another one had Music of the Galaxies, which is the CD by Italian astrophysicist Dr. Fiorella Terenzi, who I had met in California. And what she did was she recorded the signals of colliding radio galaxies through a radio telescope and used mathematical algorithms and computer programs to convert it into sound. It sounds kind of like this. So you hear some of that going in the background. And then it's got some percussion track from Mickey Hart, the guy that played with the Grateful Dead and did part of the Apocalypse Now soundtrack, the Rhythm Devils. So you've got a sound collage with these three: whales, galaxy sounds, and some Mickey Hart percussion all going at the same time. And I just sort of started them, so it's kind of random, but it's pretty cool. Then I think I'll play two tracks from my first CD of Grand Piano Improvisations. The name I use for myself in musical form is The Brink, stroke Jeff Phillips. But I've used the name The Brink since 1985. And in honor of Water and the Cetaceans, I'm going to play a track called Water from the CD called The White Electric Dog Transmissions, recorded in Portland, Oregon in July 1998. And then I'll close with a track called The Insignificance of Humanity from the same CD. Thank you for listening to On the Brink with Jeff Wefferson. Join us again next week. And please check out our website, dolphinmatrix.com, stroke Jeff with a capital J. My cetacean blog, tutunui-wananga.blogspot.com. My Facebook cetacean page called Cetaceans Not Mutations. And many, many, many thanks to Wade Carson, marine biologist in Canada, for his brilliant work with the Stranded No More WordPress and Facebook page. Always the leading edge in terms of reality-based, up-to-the-minute information about whale and dolphin strandings and their threats, and always looking through the facade of the Navy and big oil-generated propaganda wall of voodoo to show us what's really going on behind the scenes. What we're doing to the whales and dolphins is, there's a lot of really heavy stuff happening in the world, but I think that it's the absolute worst because of who they are as our very best friends and the most special beings on this beautiful mothership Earth, that we're supposed to be responsible for her safety and well-being. We're not doing a very good job, and I have very serious fears about the future of humanity as we know it in terms of how Mother Earth is going to feel when it comes time to renew our contract for existence here. So I urge everybody to get off your ass and get onto your highest path now. Act as if everything you did and don't do, everything you think, every thought you have, every intent matters, because it does. You're radiating your conscious psychic energy into the collective noospheric whole every second. We're linked in with each other, with the whole noosphere of the planet. The Schumann resonance connects us with Mother Earth and the vibrations of the whales and dolphins and possibly water-based life on other planets and other galaxies. We just don't know, but it's entirely possible. So we are on the brink of the unknown and the unknowable. There is hope, but not while people are sitting on their ass watching TV and eating meat and worried about how much money they're going to make and how they're going to consume more infotainment. I think we need to each ask more of ourselves, and we need to each heed the simple but powerful message that seems to be coming to us from the whales and dolphins right now, which is live simply so that others may simply live. Thanks for listening, and join in again next week.
Mm-hmm.